Welcome to Counterpoint. With me today is distinguished Yale professor of history, Timothy Snyder. Heralded by the magazine The Nation as perhaps the most talented younger historian of modern Europe working today, Snyder is the author of 5 award-winning books. He was in Memphis this spring talking about his most recent, Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, which was named a Book of the Year by more than 10 publications and is being translated into more than 20 languages. Tim, thanks so much for being with us today on Counterpoint.
Very glad to do it.
I have to tell you that my first reaction to Bloodlands, Tim, was that it's a brutal book to read because the brutalization narrated on every page is sometimes overwhelming, but at the same time, it was completely gripping. Why do you think that this era between Stalin and Hitler, between 1933 and 1945, holds such a morbid fascination for us? I mean, it's a time of mass death, but we can't get enough of it.
So I was doing another radio program once for public radio in New York City, and my publicist was there with me, waiting outside. And one of the questions was a similar question, and I responded by saying, you know, this book isn't actually for everyone. And what I meant was that it really isn't the case, I don't think, that everyone wants to read about killing as it actually happened, which was one of my goals. I think you're right that people are fascinated by killing is so long as they can keep a certain distance from it. I think people in general have had difficulty with this book because it doesn't allow you to take that distance. It doesn't allow you to separate yourself by way of ideology or nationality or social distance or any of the other usual ways in which we wrap ourselves so that we can then kind of peer out voyeuristically into the horror. The book is designed to treat these events as being historical events like other historical events, you know, to which prose can lead you and force you to contemplate. And that way, I'd like to think anyway that it's not a matter of morbid fascination, but a contemplation of brute, irreducible historical facts, which we then have to try to explain. Of course, after I left that radio interview, my publicist, you know, after I'd said the book wasn't for everyone, I think she was fit to strangle me.
If you're willing to sort of wade through the muck, really, here, there's enormous insights along the way, and that's part of what is so compelling and makes it such a page-turner. But I think what's really new, Tim, is the way that you approach this topic by putting a spotlight on the geographical area that became the killing fields of 14 million civilians, which will be ever more known to your readers, at least, as the Bloodlands. And you define this as the territories subject to both German and Soviet police power and associated mass killing policies at some point between 1933 and 1945. So tell us a little bit about where were the Bloodlands and how does focusing on them change how you understand not only the Holocaust and Hitler, but also the Stalin and the Soviet Union?
The book begins from a really simple observation. The observation is that 14 million human beings, children, women, men, all of them non-combatants, so none of them were killed on the battlefield. 14 million children, women, and men were deliberately murdered either by Nazi or Soviet institutions between 1933 and 1945 on a relatively compact bit of territory. So in geographical terms, what I mean by the Bloodlands are today's Poland, Ukraine, Belarus, the Baltic states, and Western Russia. Now, the number 14 million is striking in two ways. The first way that it's striking is that it's such a large number, right? Nothing like that has happened in European history before or thankfully since. But it's also a striking number in a relative sense. It's a very large number relative to how much killing the Germans and the Soviets did in all the territory they controlled. So if you look at the Nazi and the Soviet empires together, they control in, say, 1940 or 41 or 42, all of the territory from France to Siberia, most of this enormous Eurasian landmass. And on that entire territory, they deliberately killed something like 17 million, which is a huge number. But of that 17 million, 14 million are in this very, very small place, actually, very small compared to that huge Eurasian landmass. And so once you've noticed that, then you have a question, which is, why is it that this particular place was the site of not only so much killing, but so much of the total killing that took place? And so you notice some things then about this place. And the interesting thing is that everything you notice leads you back to the same territory. So you notice that, for example, this is the place where both Soviet and German power touched, as you say. So there's a large part of Europe that the Germans touched, but the Soviets didn't. A huge part of Europe and Asia that the Soviets touched, but the Germans never did. these bloodlands are precisely the places, as you say, that were touched by both. And that's no coincidence. And the second thing that you notice is that these are the territories, precisely the territories, where the Holocaust took place. Most of the Jews who died in the Holocaust lived in these places, and they and their forebears had lived in these places for generations and centuries. And those Jews who died in the Holocaust who didn't live in these places were brought here to die. That's a minority. So you notice these things which all of a sudden cast your particular understandings into a different light. Because if you think about the Holocaust as taking place on a territory, and you realize that in addition to the 5.5 million or so Jews who were murdered on this territory in what was clearly an unprecedented campaign of mass killing, an unprecedented attempt to eliminate physically an entire group, if you notice that on this territory about 8 million other people were also killed, then I think you're forced to ask questions. And you're forced to ask questions even if all you care about is the Holocaust. I mean, this is sort of the methodological twist to the whole thing. Even if all you cared about was the Holocaust, and of course I think we should care about everything, but even if all you cared about was the Holocaust, you'd have to really ask about all of these other millions of corpses that are, so to speak, in the picture. You have to ask if there's a relationship between one killing policy and other killing policies. And of course, once you think about it, it's pretty plausible, pretty intuitive that there will be, and indeed there are. And so what territory does is that it forces us out of the convenient divisions that we've inherited from the 20th century and that we use to look at only part of the catastrophe. If you look at territory and everybody who died on the territory and both of the regimes that were present on the territory, you're forced then to contemplate not just the famine in Ukraine, not just the Soviet and German murders of Polish elites, not just the Soviet Great Terror, not just the German deliberate starvation of Soviet prisoners of war, not just the Holocaust. You're forced to contemplate all of these things. I don't think you can really understand them if you only look at them from the point of view of the prisms that we've inherited from the 20th century, these ideological prisms, which we find comfortable and convenient, but which don't really help us to get to the bottom of things.
And so part of what you're saying is the focus on territory really allows a focus on the interactions between these two regimes that were contending over this area. And we'll talk more about that, but let's get into some of the specifics of the events themselves, Tim. The first three chapters of Bloodlands focuses on Stalin's mass murder of first 3.3 million Soviet citizens, mostly Ukrainians, who were deliberately starved by their own government in Soviet Ukraine in 1932 and 1933, and then hundreds of thousands of Soviet citizens killed in the Great Terror of 1937-1938. What ties these two things together was Stalin's collectivization of agriculture, the failures of collectivization, and then his focusing on a group that was blamed for these failures, protecting Stalin from the unthinkability of error, as you put it. Can you give us a quick overview of what happened in the Soviet Union between 1932 and 1938 that took these millions of lives? What happened in the Soviet famine, and then what happened with the Great Terror?
It helps a lot to think of the Soviet Union as a revolution which couldn't be completed. So when the Bolsheviks, when Lenin, Trotsky, when all of them made their revolution in 1917, they weren't thinking we're making a Russian revolution. They weren't even thinking we're making a Soviet Union, a big multinational Eurasian state. They thought we are setting off, we are sparking a European or a world revolution. We're just lighting the fuse and the explosion is going to be much, much bigger than us. Now, they then turned out to be wrong about that. The revolution didn't spread beyond the borders of the old Russian Empire, and they found themselves forced to build borders around the revolution, to turn the revolution into a state, to build, as Stalin put it, socialism in one country. But they still had the utopian aspirations, and indeed the faith, that an incredibly different sort of order could be created on Earth. And I think this is something which is difficult for us to grasp in our cynical 21st century about the ideologies of the 20th. That there was a belief in radical and quick transformation to the benefit of one group, that these sorts of things were possible, that a kind of magic almost was possible. Where does that magic come from? It comes from a vision of socialism, but it also comes from an idea of transformation, which is that you can take a backward agrarian country like the Soviet Union, and you can rev it up. You can, in an accelerated way, create all of the good things that capitalism creates, namely big cities and industry. And then you can give them over to the working class, and then you'll have happiness. and socialism. So in order to substitute for capitalism, for the long, slow, painful development of capitalism, what you need to do is use the state to create what they called socialism. And that meant taking over agriculture, controlling agriculture, extracting a surplus from agriculture, and plowing that all into the cities and into the industry. Which in practice means this thing which you've called collectivization, which means taking land which was privately owned and privately farmed and putting it under the control of the state. This has all kinds of implications. It means that the people who farm are no longer free people. It means that the land that they farm is no longer their land. And it means that basically all of their activity is now being organized centrally. Not only their work, but really their entire private lives, everything. Collectivization is the centerpiece of Stalinism. It is the thing which distinguishes Stalinist regimes, in my opinion, from other regimes. Now, the problem with collectivization is that it's not, in fact, as efficient as private agriculture. And Stalin, of course, couldn't fail. He couldn't be seen to fail because the whole premise of this enormous transformation is that it's destined by history. History has told us that these are the things which have to happen. And we're just accelerating the natural course of history. We're doing what's obviously the right thing. So if collectivization leads to the starvation of 7 or 8 million people, which it does, that can't be Stalin's fault. It can't be the Politburo's fault. It can't be the Soviet leadership's fault. It has to be the fault of saboteurs and imperialists and so on who are somehow getting in the way. Now, the starvation began in 1930 in Kazakhstan, and it continued through the 1930s, the early 1930s in southern Russia and in Ukraine. It was at its worst in Ukraine, and it was in Ukraine, the Soviet Republic of Ukraine, that Stalin developed a political theory of what was going on, namely that the Ukrainian communists who had been infected by nationalism were somehow staging all of this, were somehow preventing the Soviet Union from collecting what it should collect. And the only response to that was to just push harder, requisition more, extract more from the land, take more from the peasants, which down at the level of the individual village or the individual household meant party activists coming and taking literally all of the food, including the food that might have been on the table or on the stove. Now, because there really was an objective problem, there really was a shortage of food, these pitiless requisitions led to starvation. And the starvation was exacerbated by Stalin's attempt to blame the inhabitants of Soviet Ukraine for the entire catastrophe. So there were particular policies in late 1932, like sealing the border of Soviet Ukraine, like preventing peasants from going to cities to beg, like extracting livestock, which is your last refuge when you're hungry. All of these things were done on purpose in the full knowledge that they would lead to starvation, which they did. About 3.3 million people starved in the Soviet Republic of Ukraine. Now, as you say, this is all connected to the Great Terror of 1937 and 1938. The Great Terror of 1937 and 1938, when we think of it, we tend to think of the show trials. We tend to think of bespectacled party activists, or maybe we think of purged officers of the Red Army. But in fact, as we now know, because we know so much more about the Soviet Union than we did 20 years ago, as we now know, the Great Terror was really a mass action. It was really directed against peasants and workers. In the first instance, it was directed against politically suspect peasants. How are you a politically suspect peasant? Well, let's say that you're subject to collectivization. You resist it. You get sent to the gulag for 5 years. You survive that. You come back. It's now 1936, 1937, 1938. That makes you suspicious because, understandably, Moscow, Stalin think that you might not be entirely loyal to the regime after that experience. In that action, the major action of the Great Terror, something like 400,000 Soviet citizens are shot. The second main group of actions are the ethnic actions, the national actions. Poles, Latvians, Estonians, and others, Soviet citizens of these ethnicities, are subject to mass shooting campaigns. And the logic here is that these ethnicities are ethnicities that might have some connection to a foreign country, which might be somehow encircling the Soviet Union, taking part in a grand imperialist plot to eventually undermine, destroy the Soviet Union. Which is not entirely crazy, but what it's a sign of is this sense that collectivization has failed, that this grand modernization project has failed, that the Soviet Union, in trying to transform itself from within, has not turned itself into a fortress, has not made itself an invulnerable example of socialism for the rest of the world, but in fact has caused all kinds of distress and instability. It's caused starvation death, it's caused refugees to flee across the borders, it's made the Soviet Union vulnerable rather than making the Soviet Union strong. And it's that sense which stands behind the Great Terror, and which all in all something like 700,000 Soviet citizens are shot.
And I have to say, going through these three chapters and these pages, it's just really mind-bending. But one of the virtues of the book is that you show the logic that permitted this to unfold. If you've just tuned in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. With me today is Timothy Snyder, author of Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin. The next sections of the book, Tim, really focus on the interaction between Hitler and Stalin. You say in your conclusion at one point, only an unabashed acceptance of the similarities between the Nazi and Soviet systems permits an understanding of their differences. So what did Hitler and Stalin share in common?
I have to start by making an important distinction between two ways that you could understand in common. If I say that you and I have something in common, it might mean that we both are a certain way. We're both nearsighted, for example. Or I might mean that we have something in common like a house. You know, we share a summer house in Vermont. We don't actually, but you see what I mean. Like, in common can mean two different things. It can mean that we compare each other and we say we're alike, or it can mean that there's something which binds us. So in my book, it's more like the summer home in Vermont. It's not so much that Stalin and Hitler are alike, although there are certain similarities. It's not so much that their ideologies are alike, although again, there are certain similarities. It's not so much that the systems are alike, although there are certain similarities. The thing which binds them together, the thing which they have in common above all, is the territory. The book, you know, to repeat, is entirely about places where both of the systems were present, where both Hitler and Stalin were focusing their attention. And this allows us to revisit this whole question of comparison in a new way. Because in the past, what we've done with comparison is we've looked at the Nazi system as one thing, and we looked at the Soviet system as another thing. And we've said, okay, the Nazis have the Gestapo, the Soviets have the NKVD, Hitler was disorganized, Stalin was organized, and so on and so forth. We've looked at them as two isolated things. I think that's unsatisfactory when, in fact, what you have before you are not two isolated things, but two things which are very much present in the same place and time, and influencing each other in ways which are, I think, hard to separate from the essence of the systems themselves. So what I do, rather than trying to compare the two systems, which is something which people find incredibly interesting, what I try to do is say, wait, we're not actually ready to compare these systems because we don't understand them. In order to carry out a comparison, you have to first say, I understand these two things. I don't think we fully understand them until we understand the most important thing about them, the most important thing about them being their capacity to kill millions of people. And we can't understand that most important thing unless we understand the bloodlands, unless we understand this territory. So the whole book, in a way, is set up to undermine previous attempts at comparison and to say we need to do a lot more preparatory work before we are in a position to compare. So what comparisons there are in my book, as you probably noticed, you know, there are a few scattered between, but in the end, you know, most of them are in the conclusion. What do they have in common? What do they share? The main thing which I find which is interesting is that they didn't really learn that much from each other. This has been the standard way of approaching these two things. These are two isolated systems, but they might have learned from each other. I don't think they actually learned very much from each other. They knew much less about each other than we know about them now, which is worth keeping in mind. If you look, for example, at German killing policies, which followed Soviet killing policies, Soviet killing policies came first, German killing policies came later. The Germans don't seem to have learned anything from the Soviets. They don't even seem to have learned that you can shoot very large numbers of people. They relearned all of these things for themselves in practice. And then when they did it, they generally did it in different ways. So learning is the dominant paradigm when it comes to what they have in common, and really learning is not what it's about. I think the most important kind of interaction, or the most fateful kind of interaction, was the military alliance of 1939, which it's extremely convenient to overlook because it messes up everybody's history of the Second World War. The idea that the Second World War began as an alliance between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, as of course it did, confuses the American narrative. It certainly confuses the Soviet narrative of the war, and we just prefer to set it aside. But it's extremely important for everything that happens next, this military alliance.
You call this Molotov-Ribbentrop Europe, and it's not only this period between 1939 and 1941 that you're talking about there, right? That becomes a sort of more general way of thinking about what's going on in the interaction between the Soviet Union and the Nazi regime.
Yeah, I think 1939 has reverberations and echoes which throughout the Second World War and which continue to this day. One of them is the destruction of states. The Second World War begins with the destruction of states, the destruction of Poland, the destruction of the Baltic states, which is incredibly important for Poles and the Balts, but it's actually much more important, I think, for the Jews. The state is always more important for national minorities than it is for national majorities. And as the Holocaust later unfolds, and I'm sure we'll talk more about this, but as it later unfolds, it unfolds with the greatest severity precisely in places where the state has been destroyed. And so this moment of Soviet-German interaction, which leads to this state, which begins the war and everything which goes with the war, but also destroys these states, I think is incredibly important to focus upon. It's important also because it's the moment where the Germans begin to kill on the scale of the Soviets. You know, they have the Einsatzgruppen and these special task forces before 39, but it's only in 1939 with the invasion of Poland, with an actual war, which the Soviets helped them start, with an actual war, the Einsatzgruppen begin to kill people in very large numbers. And of course, that's only going to continue as the war continues. And then the idea of Molotov-Ribbentrop Europe is important because it establishes this overlap, that you have these two states that are now acting together. And what it means is that the moment when that alliance ends on June 22nd, 1941, when the Germans betray their Soviet allies and invade the Soviet Union, what they are invading first, the territories they're reaching first, are precisely the territories which the Soviets have just invaded, and the Soviets have just occupied, and the Soviets have just annexed. And so 1941 introduces double occupation, which is something which is typical of this region, but which is very hard for us to get our minds around. But we have to get our minds around it if we want to understand how the entire Holocaust and everything else associated with it actually unfolded.
Really, part of what you're saying is the territory itself is what they were struggling over. This is what they shared in common. And what that means is the single biggest factor that tied these two regimes together was imperialism in the case of the Nazis, and what you call self-colonization in the case of the Soviets. And then that really has implications for how you end up understanding the Holocaust itself. And I want to extrapolate a little bit on that in terms of getting you to talk a little bit more about ideology, because one of the things that you do by highlighting what it is that you do highlight is sort of dimming down the emphasis on ideology and a comparison as well of the ideologies that were both shared and that were different between the Nazi and Soviet systems. You write, for example, ideology cannot function without economics, and economics in the time and place was very much a matter of the control of territory. So can you talk a little bit, Tim, about what role you think the ideology of anti-Semitism played in the mass murder of Jews by Germans in World War II? And then also, why did anti-Semitism make a reprise in the Soviet Union almost conjointly with the rise of the Cold War? Because here it seems ideology is really flaring up in powerful and important ways that seem to drive the events.
What I think I'm doing in this book is taking ideology seriously. What we often do with ideology is we wrench it out from its historical setting, and then we make it do our intellectual work for us. You know, so we take something like anti-Semitism, which is obviously essential. It's extremely important, essential, indispensable for any explanation of the Holocaust. But we take it out of the historical setting and we just sort of equate it with causation. We say, okay, there was anti-Semitism, therefore there was a Holocaust. We confuse a necessary condition with an explanation. And in that way, I think we're actually not taking ideology very seriously. If we want to take ideology seriously, both as a historical matter and as a matter of trying to prepare ourselves for dangerous ideologies in our own times or in the future, we have to be aware of the enabling conditions, the things on which ideology has traction. So it's quite clear that anti-Semitism itself couldn't have caused a Holocaust. We had anti-Semitism in the place where the Holocaust happened, namely Eastern Europe, for the entire history of the Jews in Eastern Europe. And yet that was precisely the place where Jews enjoyed the greatest demographic success in their history. So you can't just say there was anti-Semitism, therefore there was a Holocaust, because otherwise the entire history of Jewry wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't have made any sense. It can't even happen in Nazi Germany, which is an anti-Semitic state, because in Nazi Germany, there are only about 400,000 people of Jewish origin in 1933, and then roughly half that in 1939, which is, you know, 0.25% of the population of Germany. And it's only about 3%, or actually a little bit less, of the Jews who are going to die in the Holocaust. So you have to have some kind of encounter between anti-Semitism and the state. That's the first thing. And then you have to have an encounter between that anti-Semitic state, which is Nazi Germany, and the place where the Jews actually live, which is Eastern Europe. So that's the basic way in which territory matters. You know, that's the simple argument that you have to have territory in the picture for the Holocaust to make sense. But of course, there's a deeper argument, as you suggest, about the relationship between ideology and territory. And we have to take a step back to another word you use, which is empire, to make sense of this. The Soviets and the Nazis are functioning in an imperial world. They are functioning in a world in which they both see Great Britain as the superpower. They see the source of British power quite properly in the Royal Navy and in the control of the sea lanes. They both have very ambitious notions of how to transform themselves, but those notions are confined by the geopolitical reality of British power. So what the Germans and the Soviets each have is a different response to that, which has in common the focus on Eurasia. So what the Nazis think is, one day we will be a global power. One day we will rival, destroy the British and the Americans. But in the meantime, what we have to do is build up an East European empire, which will give us agricultural self-sufficiency and wealth and a place to colonize and so on. What the Soviets think is, one day imperialism will reveal its contradictions. One day capitalism will collapse. In the meantime, we have to self-colonize. We have to collectivize. We have to make ourselves strong. So you have these two different reactions to this world of empire. And what the book tries to demonstrate is that what these visions have in common is precisely territory. That each of these visions leads you down to the same place, Eastern Europe and above all, Ukraine. Now, what does that have to do with the Jews? Well, it has everything to do with the Jews in three ways. The most basic way is that the plans for German colonization required that Germany control the world homeland of the Jews. That's the simple basic thing, which histories of the Holocaust often leave out. In order for Hitler to have the empire that he wanted, he had to control precisely the territories where the Jews lived. Second issue, how did he think he was going to come to control those areas? He thought that the Soviet Union was a Jewish state. His anti-Semitic interpretation of the Russian Revolution and of the Soviet Union was that it was a revolution by Jews, and it was a state which was run by Jews. If you could destroy the Jews, then the Slavic Untermenschen, the inferior Slavic people, would be at your disposal. You could do whatever you wanted with them. They were totally malleable. They'd be your slaves. You could starve them. You could do whatever. The territory of his empire and his technique for gaining empire involved the places where the Jews lived, and it involved an anti-Semitic interpretation of the Soviet state. It goes beyond this, because Hitler's entire interpretation of the world, as you know, as any student of these things knows, is that the world was directed against Germany because of an international Jewish conspiracy. So not only was the Soviet Union a Jewish state in Hitler's mind, the British and the Americans and their finance capitalism was also backed by Jews and only served the interests of Jews. Now, this world conspiracy might seem crazy, and of course it was, but it has a certain kind of political power. The political power it has is that if you say that these great powers in the world, the great forces in the world, are ultimately Jewish, it means that the Jews are at fault whenever anything goes wrong for Germany. Between 1933 and 1939, the things that went wrong for Germany were happening inside Germany. So, you know, there's a boycott of German products, there's bad coverage in the press, you can blame that on the Jews. There was assassination here and assassination there of a German official. You can blame that on the Jews. After 1941, the stakes are a lot higher. Hitler has this famous speech in which he says, if there's another world war, it will not lead to the destruction of Germany, but to the extermination of the Jews. After 1941, when Germany is actually trying to build this empire, the stakes are a lot higher because then Germany actually starts to lose. Things actually start to go against the Germans. An incredible alliance between the Soviet Union and the British and the Americans appears. How can you explain this? Well, you explain it by saying the only thing that could have brought together the capitalists and the communists is the Jews who stand behind both of them, right? Which is, of course, totally ludicrous, but it's a way of explaining German failure by way of Jewish power. And that way of explaining German failure by way of Jewish power becomes one more argument why you have to destroy the Jews. The first argument is we're entering the Soviet Union. We have to destroy the Jews to control the Soviet Union. Once there's a world war with all of these powers, which are defined as Jewish, arrayed against you, then you have an argument for destroying the Jews as such. So anti-Semitism has everything to do with the Holocaust, but it only makes sense when we understand what the Germans were planning to do in Eastern Europe and how the failure of their undertaking in Eastern Europe interacted with and intersected with their sort of global idea of Jewish power.
And the other thing is that, of course, these two regimes in a way sort of come to mirror one another. Each sees the other side in terms of notions of world conspiracy, in terms of this paranoid sense about their place in the world. Each divides up the world into these binary categories and comes to see themselves in terms of an us versus them notion. Tim, that was so helpful in terms of thinking a little bit about how ideology links on to politics and onto economics and onto territory in the context of the way events unfold in history. The strong note that you end Bloodlands on, and that I want to end this interview with, is that most memorializing about this era, when we think back on it, tends to focus on the victims. That's true in America, it's true in Europe, it's true in the new nation states that emerged in the aftermath of the Soviet Union and with its breakup. But you write, it's less appealing, but morally more urgent to understand the actions of the perpetrators. The moral danger, after all, is never that one might become a victim, but that one might be a perpetrator or a bystander. So what do we understand about the perpetrators from reading Bloodlands?
In a way, it's the mirror image of your last question, because all of the ways that we can be drawn to these ideologies have to do with these political or geopolitical or economic factors, which had a certain constellation in the 1920s and 1930s, and of course we'll have other constellations in the 2020s and 2030s. But the general notion that it's not enough to simply say those people were evil and I'm not. It's not enough to say I'm not a Nazi and I'm not a Stalinist. That is far too easy. And I think I fear that it's so easy as to almost to be counterproductive. In order to understand how these things actually happened, one has to understand how the perpetrators, and I think above all the bystanders, were drawn into it, how their positions were fixed the way they were. I'm not at all convinced that we are morally superior to peoples 100 years ago. It would take a lot to convince me of that. I think that we're facing slightly different circumstances. The most telling example of this is food. In the 1920s and 1930s, people counted calories because there weren't enough calories. And you needed to have enough calories to make sure that these agrarian economies could actually function. You had enough calories to get into the men, enough calories to get into the women, to get into the oxen and the horses and so on, that the economies could actually function. Now we're living in a world where we count calories because we're afraid of being fat. That's a very, very different world, and it prevents us from understanding the geopolitical competition for Ukraine that was at the heart of all of this. But it also prevents us from understanding the relationship between material factors and ideological factors. And because we don't see that, I worry a great deal that as time goes on and as some of those material factors start to reappear, we will not have prepared ourselves. We'll in a way have unprepared ourselves, because all we will have done is to reject particular ideologies, which of course are never going to come around in exactly the same form, and not realize that, let's say, after China's fertile soil goes away, or after there's no more fresh water in the Middle East and so on, that people might be confronting choices that are a little bit like the choices of the first half of the 20th century, and that the ideologies which are going to justify taking food for some people and away from others, or water for some people and away from others, might be similar to some of the ideologies that we've seen before. So in terms of moral hazard, you know, you and I, if we become victims of something, we won't have done anything wrong. We'll simply have become victims. But if you and I bystand with respect to Rwanda or Darfur, we may have done something wrong. In some future more dramatic world, you and I perpetrate in the defense of the United States or some other group against some other group, then we really will certainly have done something wrong. And I think as the history of the Holocaust and all of these events move forward, we have to come to grips with some of the harder lessons of the events, rather than just memorialize them, rather than just identify with the victims. You know, identifying with the victims is important. I mean, my entire book is based upon the premise that the significance of these events is the loss of these human beings, which we call the victims. But at the same time, once we've taken on board the human reality of the victims, we also have to take on board the human reality of everybody else and look hard at ourselves and see whether identifying with the victims is really enough. Because, of course, identifying with victims doesn't make you a victim. It doesn't make you morally clean. It just makes you somebody who identifies with victims, which is not at all the same thing.
Tim, you've really helped us get a different perspective on both Hitler and Stalin by understanding the interactions between them, and really by insisting that we understand the past best when we know something about the complexities of politics and when we connect the dots to economics, rather than taking too quickly to moralizing narratives, which oftentimes are what ends up being structured out of a focus on the victims. Thanks so much for being with us on Counterpoint.
Thank you, Jonathan, for the questions. I appreciate it.
Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face regionally and globally. Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO-FM. For an extended version of this conversation, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item, where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint from that website or by visiting the iTunes store and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO-FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. Thanks for listening.